Good evening. Good to see you all. We wanted to sort of bring our time together, hopefully back to, well, I kind of think of it like a whirlpool. We have looked at history and religious forms. We've looked at gift and challenge. And we would like this evening to bring it down to, it is a pietist thing after all, to your experience, to give you a chance to speak a little bit about the way in which this tradition, this way of understanding the religious life, has been at play in your life or the life of the community that you have been a part of, the kind of gift that has been there, and the kind of challenge and struggle that has been there. Because it is, after all, a human story. So, we can go wherever you want to go. I hope some of you will spend a little bit of time giving us all the benefit of hearing a bit of a story from your life and your experience which speaks to these matters. What's the effective kernel that you would like to walk us into a little bit? So we'll spend most of our time doing that, and if you don't want to do that, that's fine, because I've got 30 of them to tell you. So I'm going to begin, if that's okay with you. I'm going to begin with one, and it's one that as I have said, my father was the last pietist to be buried in the prairie. I expect many of you to make it clear that that's not the case tonight. I will be happy to hear that. But often we think of pietism as a peculiar kind of moralism, and we all know how caught up the community has been at times, or at least some in it, at thinking about pietism in those terms. I remember walking home from church in a fall afternoon, early afternoon, with my father, where he, well, it wasn't the only time he did this, he dissected the sermon of the clergyman who had spoken. This was in the Evangelical Covenant Church in Edmonton, which we were going to. It was within walking distance of our home. We were having a spate of these sermons which were less than, you know, orthodox and less than on the money. Woven through the sermon was a bit of hearsay, a bit of heresy. So that wasn't unusual in the church of my early teens. Our last few pastors in that church had all primarily been influenced by a form of American fundamentalism. So don't get me wrong, I'm not being critical of fundamentalism or the even American evangelicalism, but only that it is a distinct form of religious making from the religious making of pietism that had so deeply shaped my father. So these pastors were shaped by a kind of American fundamentalism. They certainly weren't pietists. They shared nothing with Hauge or Waldenström. They didn't share anything with Lutheranism either, most of the time, or even the kind of Wesleyan learning and sensibilities that at one time had been in the pulpit and the pew of that church. When we arrived home, my father went upstairs to his book-lined hallway and took down a set of sermons by the Canadian-born but famous American preacher, evangelist, Harry Ironside. Some of you may recall. And he opened it and he searched a few pages until his eye lit on a paragraph. And he read it with a combination of amusement and chagrin. Separated by an hour or so, this was the second time I heard these words. I remembered my father saying, "I wish the pastor would choose a worthy heretic when he decides to plagiarize, instead of an heretic that just isn't worth reading once. The ideas are too thin." So then our mother called us all to the table, served the usual Sunday roast beef with her extraordinary delicious gravy, which gave real purpose to mashed potatoes, peas and carrots, followed by the banana cream pie. I now have celiac disease, so consider the sacrifice. Now, I don't recall the conversation around the dinner table that day, but I suspect that it continued with a bit of dissection of that particular sermon, an opportunity for our father to teach us something about heresy and about its implications and about the fact that just because somebody was a heretic didn't mean that they weren't your pastor or that you couldn't love them. He often took a nap in the afternoon, which he did that day, for an hour or so, and then he got up and sitting in the living room when I came in. He had a cone of incense burning on the mantle. Kind of an interesting pietist to be offering incense. It may account for my journey to Orthodoxy. And he was taking deep... Now remember, he was a deacon. Taught the Bible class and all that sort of stuff. He was taking deep, satisfying puffs on a White Owl cigar. When he saw me come into the room, he started blowing smoke rings up in the air. First a large one, slowly rising, and then small ones a little faster that would move through the large one. How do you do that? I asked. This wasn't the first time he was smoking a cigar, in this periodic room. How do you do that? I asked. You'll find the cigar box in the top drawer of my side of the dresser, he said. Go and get yourself. So I was off like a flash and came back holding this rather fat cigar between my thumb and index finger. Bit the end, and I knew we didn't smoke at those. We didn't drink, we didn't smoke, we didn't dance, we didn't go to movies. This wasn't smoking. This was liturgical. So bite the end off it, he said. Take a match and light it, but you have to light the whole end. Got to be careful to get the whole end lit or it becomes a problem. So I sat down on the couch just under the deep blue lithograph of Warner Solomon's painting of Jesus weeping over Jerusalem, which I still have, by the way. My first smoke rings rose up to sort of match the discernible halo, just barely to be seen over the head of Jesus weeping over Jerusalem. I was just beginning to settle into this. Perhaps maybe my fourth puff or so. Just beginning to get the hang of it. When my mother, having heard what seemed like suspicious talk, came in from the kitchen. "Finn, Finn, what are you doing with our boy?" I was leaning back and inhaling deeply as the thought crossed my mind that this may be my last puff. And then I heard my father's affectionate calling of my mother's name, words that She couldn't resist. Solvay, Solvay. If all the devil ever gets of our David, we will be blessed indeed. If all the devil ever gets is a little cigar smoke, we will be blessed indeed. So I finished about a quarter of the cigar on that first outing and happily indulged the slight discomfort, basking, really, in having taken the first steps into manhood. I am doing it, of course, at my father's bidding. At my father's bidding. We talked a little bit about initiating our children to the world. Perhaps I was 10, or maybe 12 at the time. I smoke a cigar a couple times a year. It's a prayer of thanksgiving to the memory of that Sunday afternoon. My father's voice, my mother's voice, move gently with the smoke rings. As those rings rise up to that dwelling place in the eternal, where they speak each other's names with delight beyond measure. And my mother was right. Smoke wasn't all the devil got of me. So, what about you? I have a microphone here that I'm told works beautifully. It's also possible, if you want, to speak about some of the themes and issues, because those end up often being part of our story as well. So, who would like to enter in a little bit?
Sure you can. Thank you very much. I guess I'm holding this a little bit too close. David and the rest that have been leading these sessions, I want to first of all thank you. I found them to be very, very informative and very interesting, and that's why I haven't missed any. And I wanted to make sure
you're better here than in the legislature, right?
It could be. Well, since you mentioned the legislature, I think that's a good lead into what I might have to say here. A lot of the discussion I have found in the last, I guess this is the fifth time, have been kind of about the theology of pietism. I'm not a theologian. I think a lot of people here are not theologians, and so maybe we don't understand everything we've been hearing, at least I don't. But I'm more interested in pietism and Huggyism from the point of view of the movement itself, from the point of view of its effects on society, its effects on government, and especially its long-term effects. My background is from the Huggyan background and the pietistic background. I've been fortunate to spend a very good deal last summer in Norway, and I've visited Norway many times. I've had the opportunity to visit many relatives that I have over there, and I've observed that they really aren't very interested in Huggyanism, in pietism, and even in Christianity. And yet, one of the brothers came to America, my grandfather, and they became very, very interested in the whole movement, Huggyanism, and the pietist movement. So it seems to me that the remnants of Huggyanism are much more evident in America here than they are in the birthplace of Huggyanism or pietism in the Norwegian sense in Norway. Although it may be bleeding here, I think it's dead there. I may be wrong, but that's been my observation. Now I wonder why the difference?
and why it seems to be dead in Norway at this time. Last week, I was impressed by one of your statements. You said the effect of the script, you talked about the effect of the scriptures on a broken heart. And that struck me. I think there's a parallel. I wonder what the effect of the movement was on a broken society. And I was very impressed by what Cam Harder had to say the very first time, because he talked about that a lot. The effect on a broken society, and why pietism fell into fertile ground. And it seemed to me that that was the main thing. It was a broken society, and society was ready for it. There were hard times, poverty, people were desperate. Maybe the state church had something to do with it. I expect it did. And I suppose the third thing would be that there was a leader for the time. And I think that's always important. But as we heard Cam speak, it seemed to me that it was not only a religious movement, but it was an economic movement as well. He talked about Hans Christian Hauge as being a great one to start factories and so on. So he was concerned about the welfare of people as well as he was about the religious development. And so now as we see Norway coming from that state to the state where it is now, where it probably has the highest standard of living in the world, I wonder, is there any need for pietism anymore? Because the ground is very, very different now. It isn't fertile ground at all. Now, as you look at North America, there was no state church here when my grandfather arrived. He arrived as a homesteader. The ground was very fertile for a need for religion and a need to work together. So it was similar to Norway in that respect. I think it was you that talked about the movement, the fundamentalist movement, that kind of accompanied this in the, at least in Western Canada here. You talked about Eberhardt and you talked about Maxwell and so on. And that movement was very, very evident where I grew up. And I think it had maybe even more of an effect on me not, you know, attending dances and all the rest of it. I think they were even worse there.
Smoking cigar.
Oh, well, that was another question. So I have three questions that I would like to direct to you with this kind of background. Why has the movement failed so badly in Norway, if indeed it has? Perhaps it hasn't failed in that there was tremendous economic reform that followed, to the point where Norway is one of the richest countries in the world. Mind you, the other North Sea oil, of course, now, but something happened there. It became much more liberal, and I think that there were some effects outside the religious realm that were likely good. So that's one of my questions. Why has it done better in North America than it has in Norway? And thirdly, could it rise again under today's environment?
Well, I think you sort of answered the first question with your comment on it. I mean, I think it's the way you framed it, the whole notion of a broken society. There's tremendous opening there with an appropriate leader. Pietism is a movement. And as with all movements, they arise because of particular kinds of circumstance. And someone is there to galvanize the aspirations of people and bring them together around those aspirations, not only for the transformation of their own life personally, but certainly if they're Christian, because in the Christian tradition, individuals don't exist. In the Bible, there is no individuals. That is, we exist in communion or in alienation, in relationship to each other. That's how we exist. One of the meanings of the doctrine of the Trinity. It's relationship. So a person comes along, does that, and the transformation, which is personal, is also social and dramatically so. I recall one of the transformative moments, obviously, in the teens. I suppose it would have been, you know, in 1920, something like that. There was in Stavanger a kind of annual pilgrimage that Christian Bjelland would make from his herring factory, right on the port there, to the Dome Church, to make his annual offering of charity to the bishop. This was a big deal. It was like a parade. There was an appointed day and appointed time. When my father was a kid, playing in the churchyard, this event was occurring. But Christian Bjelland, King Oscar Sardines, huh? Who could deny the King Oscar Sardines? But he comes along, and a whole bunch of fishermen marshal and stood between him and the bishop and said very simply, justice, not charity. Look what you are doing to the fishermen who go out at sea and bring this in. So they stopped it for a moment, but that was right out of the heart of this kind of movement. So, but I agree with you entirely. I think the broken society that Tam described so well was obviously central to how this happened, why it arose at the time. I don't know about comparative, you know, if we're go with Cam, and I do, I think he's right about, I'd even state it stronger, about the Haudi movement transforming Norway. I don't think there's any question about that. It was a huge transformative movement. In a sense, it's interesting, isn't it, that the success of certain movements of necessity means they disappear. Of necessity. What minister of justice should not wish to be out of work? What minister of social services should not wish and do everything to be out of work? So I think you're absolutely right about that. Here, in our context, my own sense is that once you and I lie in the boneyard, there's not going to be very many people around that even remember as much about this as we do. I mean, my own sense is it's pretty minimal in terms of its gravity in this kind of context at this point. But that's we could talk more about that perhaps. But Rise Again. My own sense is that the key spiritual insight that I try to pull forward from this, which is this insight about the dark night, a kind of existential struggle, desert experience. That doesn't need to rise again, because, like it or not, many human beings walk that path at some point. So the language of the transformative experience that can occur there may shift and change at times, but certainly some way of identifying that experience and blessing that experience and seeing the power of that experience and then seeking to give some shape and form to it is part of the ongoing task of the church and all those who care about these things. Can I just over here?
I don't think I need the mic.
Yes, you do. No, you don't. We want to hear every word you say. I covered your reaction to a couple of historians and their negative critique of Hudson. And I think it's fair, I don't think it's cynical to say if we present on a topic, we want both positive and negative critique. The first I want you to respond to, please, is Conrad Bergamo, a Swedish Lutheran American theologian who writes about pietism, and he ends his chapter with the fruits of pietism. Do I need this?
Yes, yes. Some grace.
Oh, does it?
Some
even without?
No. Some grace.
Oh, okay. The fruits of pietism, and he mentions many of them, all positive. Willingly or unwillingly, leaders of the churches in Lutheran lands have conceded the validity of much of pietistic criticism. And then he cites some of those criticisms and how valid they were. And then he ends with a negative critique, and this is the first one I want you to comment on, and then a second one from Martin Martin. Many and salutary as the fruits were, it must be admitted that pietism's intense concentration on the religious experience of the individual meant a contraction of the interpretation of the Word of God. The spiritual experience was often expressed in terms of intimacy with the loving Savior whose blessings were personally appropriated. Luther's teaching of the hidden God, the Deus Absconditus, who cannot be known, but whose awfulness inspires humility and ineffable reverence, was lost in pietistic self-analysis. Along with this attitude went a withdrawal from and condemnation of the world, in quotes, world. The salvation of one's own soul was so paramount that pietism had no understanding of the salvation of the world for which Christ died. The gap between the church and the world, caused by the development of a secular culture and state, was widened by the withdrawal of pietistic conventicles into their own associations as they waited for the end of the world. Now, the critical point here I'd like to hear your comment on is the concentration on religious experience of the individual meant a contraction in the interpretation of the Word of God. Now, can I fire with a second one before you respond?
Well,
Martin.
We go back, so.
This is from his Short History of Christianity. After reviewing pietism and the effect, how it survived Daniel Kant and his philosophy, and how it was affected by Hegel, then he speaks of Schleiermacher, as the great mind of the 19th century, who wanted, he says, to elevate and bring into the Christian orbit the concerns of earlier pietism. Against the cold moralism of Kantianism, his stress was on feeling in religion, on intuition in spiritual response. And then Marty makes this negative critique. I want you to respond to that, please. His obsession with affections led him to interest in the doctrines until the Christian life is simply the ethical response to Christ's example. And Schleiermacher tended to run faith out in favor of ethical response. Schleiermacher raised more questions than he solved in the matter of apostolic reference or historical theology. The shadow of all the doctrines was there, but the psychologizing, which makes them plausible, also gives one a slippery feeling. For him, it is experience that becomes deified, and the consciousness of the church is normative as opposed to scripture. In spite of all the study of scripture, the consciousness of the church becomes normative, and experience becomes deified. They are coming.
Well,
if I was to shape a lecture around that problem, I would have to tell you a story about myself and about the inheritance of the deifying of one's own experience. That clearly is the Achilles heel of pietism. It is also one of the reasons it is a genus and it's an Achilles heel. That is why pietism desperately needs the ecclesia, the church in all its riches. Otherwise, what happens to it is what I spoke about, both with the colonization of fundamentalism, evangelicalism, and a whole range of other things. I have no difficulty with either of those comments, those critical comments about pietism. I will also say that I wrestled with that certainly as a child. I saw it all over the place and had a huge wrestling match with it later in my own life. These things get in you, and you can find yourself in a very a difficult place. But at the same time, the dismissal of pietism that has characterized the generation of the clergy in the liberal Lutheran church that I have seen is, it seems to me, an equally problematic problem, because it does not take human experience seriously enough. So, my sense is that there can be all kinds of idolatries that occur. And Marty and the Swedish historian have identified the danger in a pietism that has lost the body of the church and has removed itself from the tradition. There is a reason why I entered the Orthodox Church. And this speaks to that reason. But let me tell you something. When I entered the Orthodox Church, it was like the past coming to meet me from the future. Why? Because a Russian reformer, a monk named Tikhon of Zadan, considered a saint in the Russian church. Tikhon of Zadan was a friend of Dostoevsky. Dostoevsky, the Brothers Karamazov, in my view, is the greatest spiritual writer this era. Dostoevsky knew Tikhon of Zadan, and Tikhon began a reform in Russia and in monasteries in Russia. He gathered a group of disciples around him, and he said to them over and over and over again, read Arndt. Johann Arndt, the grandfather of pietism, his book True Christianity, even translated into Russian, he had them read Arndt. Why is that? Because in the state of the Russian church, you have the opposite problem. You have a highly liturgical liturgy, I love, highly liturgical life with a clerical class that is virtually a caste and all kinds of political power. And buried underneath that is Paul's description of the spiritual journey, is what Jesus Christ calls us to. Tikhon said, read Arndt in order to restore, not to take out of the church, but to restore to part of the central task of the church, which is to give human beings some language
around the deep and profound spiritual struggles that are so common. But to do it, not in order to become romantically attached to personal experience, even romantically attached to the dark night of the soul. Because you and I both know that can happen, and Pietists did that. But it's not the only option. So my point, I have no difficulty with those critiques at all. I think they're on the money. But we must remember, they are not a critique of the genius of Pietism. When they become a critique of that, they are cutting the broken heart out of human experience. So, it's a question of how do these things hang together? How do we hold and treasure what exists here? And there is this huge question about how do we cultivate a rich and textured church which can hold such life movements within it without getting blown out of its own orbit. But I appreciate your raising them so well.
We need some women here, too.
I'm sorry. Could I get you to use the other microphone? Can I ask you to use the other microphone when you respond? It's much clearer.
Sure. Thank you very much.
I was just going to respond to something that Leroy said, and I sort of was musing a little bit about, you wrote a few things down, just Norway's wealth may not, I think it could be more rooted in Pietism than we think, in terms of how it cares for its population, even if it's not evident in church. And I just think, for instance, how they've used their oil resources. I think that they didn't use them to make corporations incredibly wealthy. I think how they envisioned taxation, their taxation, it was to make the wealth available to the whole population in terms of the future, but also adequately funding public programs like health, education, supporting mentally ill people, the developmentally delayed, other vulnerable people in the society, and wealth that wouldn't mean that one has to constantly watch for cuts to these people programs. And it's just a striking contrast when I look at, we can have $2 billion in a blink for carbon capture that hasn't even been proven as a technology, but we're constantly having, as public members, to struggle when we hear the stories from nurses and teachers and doctors for public services. So I wonder if Pietism isn't alive and extremely well in Norway, actually, in how it cares for its population and its vulnerable members.
It's migrated to a... But one thing to say is Pietism is wealth. It's another thing to say that the society is healthy because it had that period in its history. Yeah. Interesting. Pardon.
Thank you. It's kind of a dangerous thing to give the microphone to a pastor because, you know, you never are sure just when he's going to have everything finished so he can close.
But even will close away from you, so don't worry.
I see. All right. So I think maybe I should, as I begin, pray the prayer of a black pastor many years ago down in the States. He prayed this: Lord, fill my mind and mouth with worthwhile stuff and shut me up when I've said enough. I kind of like that. Well, I'm not going to respond particularly to the last discussions that you had with Walt Ritter, but I think you've answered very well. However, I would say this by observation and a bit of experience, that Lutheran churches view Pietism quite differently and often in the negative sense. In my grad studies, while most of it was taken in Luther Seminary in St. Paul, Minnesota. In 1965, I was in St. Louis and took a few courses there in the summer study, which I appreciated very much. I remember being in the museum and seeing the monkey that the C.F. Walther and his students used today downtown. And I remember quite vividly, and I'm sure Walther remembers that it is still there, a placard that was there beside the monkey, fairly close, and it said something like this. When our group first came to Berry County, if I remember right, it was about 1835, we were faced with two difficulties that were oppressing us, one from without and one from within. The pressure from without was exerted by rationalism. The difficulty within was pietism. And then the statement in conclusion was this: thank God the church withstood the both. Now that gives us, I think, a little insight into the difference of opinion probably that exists, and doing it from one side at least, as it was presented in that plaque. With regard to this series that we are having here, I want to express a word of gratitude again, even though it's often been expressed, to you, Dr. Goam, and to you, Dietmar, and to Messiah Church, of course, the Ronning Center, and to Pastor Ken, and also to CLBI and Pastor Harold for bringing this to us. It has been tremendously enriching, and I think it's something that was long overdue, and because it's something that I think in our day has been increasingly overlooked, or perhaps somehow or another by other pressing things at hand that call for our attention, causes pietism to lose the place that it once had in the church. And I guess I would say most particularly here, those of us who are from the background of what was called most recently the Evangelical Lutheran Church in Canada, or before that most particularly the Evangelical Lutheran Church. Yeah. Now, going on from there, I would like to say that I certainly, like Lee Roy, grew up in a place, a community, in a church where pietism was highly respected. I can remember Bible studies or Bible conferences that were held. I remember when Ludwig Hope, now that's a name that some of us know, a layman, of course long departed to meet with the Lord, came and spoke in our home church. Yes, in the Norwegian language, and at that time particularly, my grasp of the Norwegian was very poor. It's not that great yet, but at least I can follow along.
As soon as you go to heaven, you will speak it perfectly.
That's right. It's like the lady that said, you know, we should really all learn the language that the Apostle Paul taught, which is Norwegian. And of course, that's not biased. Well, coming back to the comments, particularly that Leroy has made, concerning his experience in Norway, which I appreciate very much. I want to say there is, in my opinion, and from my experience in Norway, another side which is quite different also from what you have described. And it could be that we have moved in different circles. As far as relatives are concerned, I don't have any close relatives in Norway, because on both my father's side and my mother's side, most of them emigrated to the United States, and some of them from there up here into Canada. However, in 1966, it was my good fortune to have a little scholarship from the Lutheran World Federation to study the Bible school movement of Norway. And I was there for about 3 months, September, up until just before Christmas. I was mainly with the movements of Norway, more than I was consequently with the churches, that is the official churches. However, I did get to visit several of the cathedral churches, or the domkirke, as they say in Norway, in Oslo, Stavanger, Trondheim, for example. So I had some contact with them and with the pastors of the church as well. But I had a lot of contact with the Bible school movement of Norway, which was particularly the challenge that was given me in the scholarship. Now, that's back in 1966, so it's kind of old hat, we can say. I could say I updated it in 1989, when my wife and I also took a trip back to Norway. However, this time it was more like 3 weeks rather than 3 months, but visiting some of the places and not as thoroughly as what I'd done in 1966. You know, when it comes to analyzing the Church of Norway, I feel there's often a misunderstanding or a misapplication that's involved. I remember asking several of the pastors and lay people in Norway, when the word church is used, is it always used of the state church, or does it embrace also the movements that are in Norway? And the movements, of course, trace their history to the Pietistic movement and to Hans Nielsen Hauge. By the way, I also visited the home in Tuna, a little ways out from Oslo in Norway, which is now part of the museum. And I felt, because of my background and my experience, that in a sense I was in holy ground, because that's the home where Hans Nielsen Hauge was, in the eastern part of Norway. Well, coming back to the Bible school movement of Norway, it is very vast. I can't tell you right at the moment how many Bible schools there are in Norway, but there are many of them on the east coast, the southern coast, the west coast, and up north. And not only are there Bible schools, and as far as I know, they're still functioning very well, with good attendance, at least they were in the days when we were back there. I stayed at several of them, mostly in Oslo, however, and there are 3 Bible schools of Lutheran background that are right within Oslo itself. And there are, in addition, what they call Christian folk high schools that are also sponsored by the mission movements. And these are many in number, with a Christian emphasis. It was not my privilege or responsibility to study the folk high schools of Norway, but I did stay at one of them and learn something about it, and the emphasis, which is in keeping with, you know, its Pietistic background. Several people from here have also studied at some of these schools, these full Christian schools. When Billy Graham visited Norway and held a crusade over there, I'm sorry that I cannot remember the exact year. I presume it was in the 1980s, in all probability. In his first sermon, as was his custom, when he was in these crusades, he would say something historically and spiritually about the country in which was hosting the crusade. And I remember one of the statements he made about Norway, and I use this because I think it brings out the other side to what you were talking about in your experience in Norway, Leroy. He said, Norway is the most Christian country on the face of the globe. And then he went on to say, you know, if you count the number of Norwegian missionaries today, and then find the percentage of the population of something like 4 million that are in the mission field, the percentage is higher than any other country in all the world. Now, I better be careful. because I have on a garment that has the Norwegian flag. And I guess I should apologize for that in this sense, that, you know, I am Canadian, although I also have U.S. citizenship, but my heritage happens to be from Norway. But I am really Canadian by conviction, too. But it's a Olympic year, so I felt I could put it on tonight, because what do you have a garment for unless you wear it, in other words? Well, coming just back for a few more comments. I believe personally that when we're talking about the Church of Norway, we must also include the movements. Beside many of the state churches, there are prayer houses. They're called prayer houses, bedehuset. And they have people that go there. I've attended some of them in my studies all over there as well. And I believe that, you know, these movements are very influential in the life of the church. The question as to about its separateness from the organized church, of course, comes up, and whether or not there's an impact that is being made in society, and I believe there is. And in many instances, depending on the pastor and his particular persuasion, whether he has an understanding at all of pietism, there's a good relationship that exists between those prayer fellowships and the state church. So, while I'm outdated,
we need to look at the church in terms of all these movements.
Well, that is my conviction. And when we hear statistics about church attendance, I think it's nearly always referring to state church attendance, which is deplorable. But if we take in the movements, we'll find the church attendance is very different. And while there are many things that are happening in Norway today, and which Leroy is describing, that are sad, unfortunately, there is still a very vital lay movement. And when I asked some of the leaders in the lay movement in Norway, lay movements, as to how many workers there are that are essentially full-time, using that term, in the work of the church, such as lay evangelists and teachers and so on, one person said, I believe that it's right to say there are about 1,000 lay people actively involved in the ministries of the lay movements.
Great. Thank you, Arnold. We should have you come sometime and to the Ronnie Center and give a fulsome account of what you experienced there and what you saw. Thank you.
My name is Trevor Davis, and I happen to grow up in a small town called Hagen, Saskatchewan. And actually, Pastor Hagen relates a few stories about playing baseball with my father. I guess he was the pitcher and my dad was the catcher. So that's the history I come from. There was a three-point Lutheran parish out there, and we went to the country church, and I think that's pretty much where you grew up, isn't it, Pastor Hagen? So, therefore, that's the history I come out of. And first off, let me comment, it was good to be here for this history lesson, because I think there's a lot of people my age group that don't really know the history of where we come from. And I admit to being quite ignorant of most of it, so I found this educational. Just a comment on my personal experience of growing up on the prairies in a pietistical church and background. I remember being a teenager, I'll just share a story, of when I came to a real realization of what my faith was about. And sometimes it seemed that and in my teenage mind anyway, it was more important what I did than what I believed or what I wanted to do. I had that struggle that Paul speaks about. I was a teenager. In the 60s.
Spoke of that struggle as a teenager.
In the 60s. And from my background, I thought, why do I want these things that I've learned through my church are wrong? And I thought, boy, I wonder if I'm even a Christian. I was baptized in the faith. I was brought up in the church. Looking back on it, I realized that I was a Christian all the time, but it really brought it to a head. That questioning of, well, if I want all of this, do I even have faith? What's it all about? And so I remember I had a couple of cousins that were my own age going through their own struggles. And we would have some really significant discussions about this. And I think, I don't know if I was the first one, that I was a little older than a couple of them, it came to a realization that it didn't really matter what I wanted in some senses. But what mattered was who I believed in and where my faith lied. And therefore, in relation to all of the legalism and stuff like that that's around pietism, whether it's intentional or not, sometimes the message we send as a church, it's more important what you're like than what your faith is about. I don't know if I'm saying that very clearly or very well, but I think you understand what I'm saying. And so when I raised my children, I wanted to make sure that they knew that they had their own faith, and that they would go through struggles, and they would want to do things that maybe weren't technically correct, but what was correct, what is truth, what is sin, all of those questions come together, and we need to have that discussion. Anyway, just stop the thoughts.
I found last week when you were talking about the codependent twins, and I was raised in the liberal historic critical method, and have long recognized some of the sterility of that, and concerned and balanced by what I discovered in these lectures, my German pietist heritage that I didn't realize I had until I came to these lectures. And I've seen that battle in the church. You talk about a third way. And I wonder if you could say a little bit more about that in terms of how do you think that might play out in the church today?
What did you hear about this third way?
Well, I heard that it involves a wrestling with Scripture, an encounter with a living word, not making it a flat word that's caged in a book, but that part of what you're going to talk about. That I identify with that struggle. That's, yeah, I think he said this, that I'm wondering, is that the direction you're talking about? It's not Pat, I'm not expecting Pat answer, but is it, are you talking about that honest kind of struggling with the word, and that wrestling and being open to that?
The third way. I think key to what I was driving at is part of the gift of pietism. Your experience is your experience. It counts. It is meaningful. And taking into account the fact that one can create an idol out of that, no question. And Pontius did. But the insight is profound. To the experience, or what people imagine their experience to be, of your brothers and sisters in the world is something you need to be open to. Sit with tenderly and hold tenderly. When it comes to the word about the word, that is the Bible, I was simply pointing to a way of reading. It's a way of reading which is listening. It is to listen to what the text, the narrative, has to say to what I have experienced today, as opposed to searching for something or trying to prove something. So it's an entirely different stance, but you know, truth be known, many people in the Pietist world and all other places in the church, movements and otherwise, have bits and pieces of all these. Just depends on when they kick in. I was blessed to see that struggle in my father, in this place, and to also see in his attitude and his approach and his way of standing in the face of the world a remarkable kind of openness to what was unfolding and not assuming about it. You know, the word, we are often confused. We often conflate belief and faith. Belief is a secondary world. It's a world of beautiful and wonderful abstraction, a world of idea, but a secondary world. But faith, even to Thomas Aquinas, was a disposition. It's a disposition of the mind. And what is that disposition? It is to be open and attentive to what is unfolding before you. Open and attentive to what is unfolding before you. And to seek that which is meaningful in what is unfolding. Not to try and blind people to it with abstraction. But that, so when we say that a person has faith, we don't mean they believe in a set of things. We're referring to a stance, a way of being in the face of what the world has to deliver to you. Let me give you a little story about faith. When I was 15, my father, I'm sure he must have lied, he arranged for me to work on a government job as a laborer. He was building the greenhouse just below the legislative buildings in Edmonton. And so it's the first, I was 16 in the 15th of August that summer, but I went to work in July. And it was wonderful to see a whole group of Iroquois do the steel work on that building. And to see a man drive a D9 Caterpillar as delicately as my mother would do her dunger crocheting. It was amazing. And after being on that job for 2-3 weeks, and after my first paycheck on one Saturday, my father came into my room, sat down on the bed, I was sitting reading because I'd gotten paid a couple weeks before, and I bought the two-volume Wilhelm Windelband, History of Philosophy. What a choice. Now, there are histories of philosophy which are accessible, but Wilhelm Windelband? So I was struggling to get through his introduction. And my father came in and sat down. And he didn't often come into my room. I mean, there was something about this moment that was distinct. So he sat down, and I sort of turned around from my chair by my desk. And he started just reflecting a little bit on how, you know, I was working now. Pretty soon I'd be 16. And then he stood up, and I stood up. And he looked like he had tears in his eyes. He wasn't given to weeping. He had the gift, however. And he proceeded to say to me, "You know, Sonny boy, your mom and I, we have done our best to raise you. We have loved you. We have done our best within our capacity to raise you." And then he stepped closer, put his arms around me, and prayed, as he often did, the great benediction, with his hands on my head. "May God bless you and keep you, and make his face to shine upon you, and give him his peace." "You will be a man soon. I hope that God will give us the grace to meet again when you are a man. Go now. Engage the world. God be with you. I want you to know that I will never stay away from you again. I will not inquire as to what you are doing. I have confidence in God's grace. And I hope we will meet again. I can't promise you your mother won't stay awake. But I am always here for you. I am happy to listen to you. But I will no longer tell you." That is faith. That is faith. That is someone, and I, of course, didn't know at the time about his own leaving Norway, but I am certain on that Saturday afternoon that his own, as the image of himself as a 19-year-old in his mother's house in Norway, was ever present to his mind. So, in the reading of the text, I mean, I think this is one of the things that's cultivated in you from a deep reading of biblical narrative. A deep reading of biblical narrative doesn't give you truth. It gives you the way, the truth, and the life. Who is a person, anointed person? Jesus Christ. It's a model for how to be. So, the reading of the narratives, however, I grew up with them the way they were in our home. There was all kinds of proof texting going on. But there wasn't just that. There was also this amazing way in which a particular biblical narrative could be drawn in to a particular experience in our life. And they would talk to each other. Because the biblical revelation is not over. Because our story isn't over. They talk to each other. just as they do within the Bible. I mean, the Bible is not like the Quran. The Bible is stories told about stories told about stories. Over and over and over again.
Why is that?
Because in the Jewish tradition, in the Christian tradition, the act of trying to understand ourselves is holy. It is holy. Not what we understand, but the act itself. It builds our wholeness, which is the only thing holy really means. So, somebody else want to dig in?
For those who don't know me, I'm Vincent Erickson. And what I have to say is, it might be fragmentary, and it's likely to be about fact rather than about faith. First of all, about the, I come from a Swedish heritage, and my parents were affected by Pietism, though in some respects diluted in a way. They held a strong reverence for the Bible and reading all the time, a strong reverence for hymns, but not on just the what might have been called Pietistic hymns, so they included them, but also the chorales of the church. My grandfather, my father's parent, my father left an account of his life, which my father translated from Swedish into English. And from my understanding, the Swedish Pietistic movement began somewhere in the 1840s, affected by English merchants who were Methodists. But a great deal of it against the background of alcoholism in Sweden. There was a joke about the greatest hymn writer in Sweden who became archbishop that he was an alcoholic and also a pub crawler, and that once when he was out late, he asked the watchman what the time was, and it was a certain time, and the watchman also could recite, make poetry, and said, it couldn't be this late, or the archbishop couldn't be out. But there was this contrast against rapid alcoholism. Apparently, my grandfather was in the movement in the, I suppose, late 60s and 1870s. And by that time, the relationship was not with any Methodist in England, but from the school of attendance in Stockholm, the Johan Lundsvetter Institute, with the Free Church of Scotland. So both my grandfather first and then later his fiancée spent some time in Edinburgh to improve their English, and were there at the time when I'm forgetting the name at the moment, the hymn writer of the Free Church was still living. Then apparently my grandfather was about a year as a missionary in Lapland, and then he was ordained by someone in the state church. But about that time, the new head of the institute, Waldenström, forefather of the mission covenanters, and produced a great split in the school. And there were five that went to India at the same time, including my grandfather. And he records that all the way out to the argument about theology, three of them following Waldenström, and the two of them, including my grandfather, the traditional Lutheran teacher. Well, that's perhaps a little bit about that. The other fragment I'd like to say is what is being covered in other ways here about the influence of the American fundamentalism. I can remember the some of the radio broadcasts from CSN Calgary, late 1940s. And in the interesting book, unfortunately published many years later, W.E. Mann, I believe the title Sect Cult or Cult Sect and Church in Alberta, covers the period from the 20s through the 40s. And he writes that one of these families, to whom my mother listened and sent contributions, came to Canada from somewhere in the United States to make enough money so they could start a church in the United States, build a church in the United And they had split an organization on economists. In my teens, my father sent me to a Bible camps that were ostensibly or nominally led by Christian companies. The influence there was highly Baptist. And it was not until later in life, visiting in the United States, knowing some pastors there, and an uncle of mine who was a pastor, that I found that in the United States, the relationship was much closer to the Lutherans.
Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate the comment you made about the difference between beliefs, and faith. As a child, I remember being told what to believe. But I do not remember a lot of discussion in our home about faith and what faith really was. We memorized an enormous amount of scripture in both Spanish and English. There were lots of rules and regulations. There were no movies, no dancing, no makeup, no anything. I couldn't wear red or yellow to church. That was not acceptable. This was all part of our belief structure, which in retrospect seemed to put us a notch above whatever. Right? That's how it kind of rolled up. However, there had to be a lot of faith there. I can't recall how my parents defined faith for me. It happened. In retrospect, as a much older adult, I now recognize that my father, when he drove me up to Canada and left me here, I was 15 years old, there had to be a tremendous amount of faith and trust. And I look at it back now. If I were to do that with my own children, I don't think I could. So there was a real gap in the experience of, or I don't know if it was a lack of teaching or if it was a lack, it wasn't that it wasn't there.
Maybe just a gap in the language.
And the gap in the language, or a gap because as a missionary there was no time for the kids. That also entered into it. But there was a real, there was something certainly missing that I learned many years later as an adult in then defining how I believe and what faith means to me.
Beautiful spoken, thank you.
Faith, hope, and love abide, but the greatest of these is love. When I listen to you sharing the beautiful way in which you and your dad and your mom related to one another, I think I could summarize it very nicely by saying, love was the key. And so when we talk about the third way, is that not our answer? How we struggle within the church, how we judge one another constantly. And it seems to me the strength of Pietism was there was a large element of love for one another, quite apart from Edwards' genes. Obviously there were many weaknesses. No movement is perfect. We are by nature sinful. There's no such thing as perfection. But there was a spiritual love. And it was adequate for that time and achieved God's purposes, I'm sure. And that was wonderful. And so I'm just reflecting on that, how necessary it would be to maybe include that same spirit as we look forward to the many issues that we are addressing in our church. I don't know what the answer is, how you put that into practice for some areas, but surely that must be the center of it all.
Thank you.
Hi, your dad is the last pious summer that I feel like I was one of the last to leave and come back here. I feel once again like I'm 15 back at church in some ways. And what my experience has been somewhat different as a child in the 60s as well. I'll say, first of all, this disclaimer. I understand today that what I heard wasn't always what was said, and what I learned wasn't always what was taught. That is true. But in growing up in this church, by the time I was 18, I had learned, this was my pietism, I guess, was to me. I had learned about this clipboard God who walked around with his long hair and his clipboard and wrote down every bad thing I'd ever done. I learned the rules of lists and do's and don'ts, and I learned if you look good, you are good. And it doesn't really matter how you feel inside. I couldn't wait to leave that. And I learned also, if you laugh too much or you smile too much, you must be seen. That's how I experienced all of this. And now you're telling me here that the roots of pietism, the genius, if you will, is that how we want a renewal of a personal encounter with Christ through the dark night of the soul, if I could just summarize that so briefly. And what's interesting is I had to leave, and I understand, I really appreciate you saying that in learning that and having all the rules and all the do's and don'ts, I get it that my parents wanted to protect me from that dark night of the soul. What's fascinating and interesting is I sort of had my own wandering about for many years, experienced a dark night of the soul, which brought me back here. And so I still had to have that encounter. And I think I'm not alone in that. And I've come to learn here, though, that many people stayed and still encountered that and lived through it using these gifts, where I, on the other hand, rejected them, have now come back to embrace the ones that worked for me. So I just find it all really fascinating that pietism started as an encounter because of the darkness of the soul, and then it moved over here, and they wanted to keep us from that, which for some of us chases away anyway, and then came back. If that makes any sense, that's sort of my experience.
Thank you.
I'd be a little bit timid to speak because I'm kind of relishing all the reflections and reminiscences of my elders in this august setting. But I've been mulling here and trying to diagnose what is the current moment of the church. One of the things I hear and I've heard tonight and on other occasions is how the church in the recent past has been so filled with abstractions, you know, and just a lot of belief, but not conveying very successfully the faith. And if that's the case, is it time for the church to go and read Arndt, like you were speaking there? Is it time to hold up the pietist experience and offer that for people? Maybe it is. And on the other hand, it seems like we're living in a culture that is so filled with narcissism, and where experience is, people are just lost in their own experience, which is the arbiter of everything. And so in that wider light, is it time for the church to say, go and read Karl Barth or something, the word outside, you know, forget about your experience, it's the, lift up the traditions and the rituals of the church. I don't know. Those are kind of things I'm struggling with. I invite your comment or others here too.
You can read two books at the same time.
I didn't mean to be flip about that. No, I think it's beautiful the way you put that, and it's really something worth wrestling with. So.
I think it's something worth wrestling with as well, and it brings to mind the importance then. It brings to mind the importance of holding attention. And so when we think about the experience, and a place to bring the experience could perhaps be the church. And the church could be a place to support the individual, to hold the experience, and to know the experience, and to know the experience. Because to know ourselves and to understand our experience is holy. And certainly, from a pastoral counselor position, people do come with beautiful and sacred experiences that they have no place to go. And the importance of them sharing and sharing the experience and knowing themselves is that the beauty of the experience is something that can permeate them. And so if an experience of grace is there, we can only, you know, just imagine, which is part of the pietist movement, is imagine as well how then that experience, as in how an experience of the dark night of soul and an experience of grace, that experience of grace, and from that point, where did you go with it? So I believe that it's the holding of the tension. It isn't that an individual who's had that experience, perhaps some would become narcissistic, but many would not, because the information from the experience is one of grace and love and communion, and I believe it informs people to become better and better and more holy in their lives. So I really believe holding the tension is really a key piece. And the home of the church is the place to keep people grounded and being able to really move into an experience in a healthy way.
Thank you. That's assuming, of course, that people have some kind of church. But, of course, it's interesting, where is church these days? Just as in Norway, as you were describing, church is also migrated. I mean, it is where we think of it, but like it or not, it's also in women's reading circles. It's in groups of people that gather together to reflect with each other on a variety of things. So it is in a variety of places. I think that this, you know, the conventicle, there are things we can learn from the conventicle. You know, that kind of gathering that occurred and the power of that was extraordinary. Of course, it has an ancient history. Jesus never read the Bible alone, ever. And he never read it silently. He always read it with 10 people around him, because it's too hot when it meets your own experience. It's too hot for you to be left alone with what you think it means. You need the common thinking around the circle.
I just can't believe I'm brave enough to speak up. But in 1943, I had two cousins that had been very excited about going to Bible school. And we met the Finn Goas, and I know that I'm older than Mr. Dave Cohen, because he was a toddler along with his parents.
When I was born old.
anyway, I'm a very practical person. I came from practical parents, and I am so thankful that they had the heritage. My mother came right from Norway. My dad was born in the States, but his parents had come from Norway. So the baptism and confirmation was very important, and it seemed I was thankful that my parents saw the way to send me to Kamloops College at that time. And, you know, it's just been a real guiding source. I have many friends in here that have had ties with Augustana, as it is known now. And my life was guided through the university studies, and so I became a teacher. I remember asking my confirmation pastor about, there was so much said about full-time work, and I know some of my friends were quite confused. Did they have to go into full-time work to be a Christian? So I asked him, I said, you know, I'd like to be a teacher. Would that be all right? He said, it's a very honorable profession, and he encouraged me. So I was very thankful for that. And so I met my future husband out in the Armstrong area, where his grandfather was a very big post in starting that congregation. And, you know, Thorgrim stayed in Norway a year after his parents had come to the States to finish his confirmation. And it wasn't, well, I thought that was pretty important when Cam Carter or somebody mentioned something about the king had passed a law that they had to have confirmation. I thought maybe that's why he stayed. But, you know, he needed that because they started Sunday school, they started choirs, and eventually the person Anderson organized the congregation in Scandia. It's still going after 100 years, almost 110. So that's the practical side of pietism, if you want to call it.
Thank you very much.
Going back to Norway.
Oh, from Norway.
I remember that we went there on a trip one time, and our son was with us, and the comment that we made the first while we were there was that we had visited more graveyards than we had churches. Finally, we did get to a church. Our son was from El Salvador, and he had a pastor from Fredrickson, from the Dominica there, who had been in El Salvador working. And so I sort of go along with what Mrs. Had said about the work that the Norwegians do in poverty.
Right.
And
caring
for
common good.
AIDS.
Yeah.
Because this pastor, that's where my son met him, was in El Salvador doing that kind of work. And he, their church and other places in Norway have supported the work in El Salvador.
Mm-hmm. Great.
I can't believe that I'm actually saying something I had no intention to when I came here. I'm not a pietist. I'm not even a Lutheran. I'm not even a Cambrosian. I'm not even an Albertan. But I have been tremendously impressed the last few weeks listening to these gatherings. I sense from all of you and the comments you made the spiritual struggles that you've had in your life, but what has impressed me the most, and I would hate to have you lose sight of, is that you have an incredible sense of connection with your roots. It seems so important to you. I come from the Easter originally, and that is missing there, maybe because people have been there so long. And I have this feeling here that people still feel somewhat like newcomers, and they still feel attached to the past that has brought them here. And it's a very, very rich tradition, and I think that you should be proud of it. And in spite of the tensions and struggles that you are able to identify here, is something beautiful about the whole thing.
Would you share what you have found in the Orthodox Church?
I'm happy to do that, but it would be on another occasion. One more, and then we should pull the coffee.
Thank you. I thought you were speaking over there about small groups or fellowship time. And Norway found that they needed that Buddha house for small groups. And when I came here 25 years ago, that was the most blessing in my life, because I really needed to be sheltered and I needed to be listened to. And in turn, then I was able to be a part of small groups and one who could give that kind of support and listen. And so the experiences that maybe wouldn't otherwise be experienced were as we shared. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where our churches need to be. Small groups.
Well, may I just give you a little piece of Arnold's story. Mainly because it carries within it what I see as a kind of pietist credo. In December of 1968, my father and mother were both in the hospital at the same time. I was in Chicago studying, and I got a phone call from my mother. I can't recall whether it was Christmas Day or the day after, that my father had had an operation, and the doctor was relieved to have pulled him out of anaphylactic shock on the surgery table. But the news was pretty straightforward. They couldn't do anything about the cancer. So he came home, and the first week of January, I came from Chicago to spend that week with him. I read in Paul Tillich on pietism, by the way. You'll appreciate this, I hope. And my father said, when he listened to this, "My Lord, that liberalism shares far more with pietism than I ever imagined. I should have read it instead of allowing those professors to get in my way." We had an extraordinary week together, talking, it seemed like 18 hours a day, and his energy boomed. And I went back to Chicago and called every week to see how he was, and talked. And then in mid-May, when I asked, "How are you?" "He, is it time for me to come?" He said yes. So I got in the car and I drove from Chicago virtually nonstop to Edmonton. Some difficulties along the way as I thought about him and realized what was coming to greet us. Only when I turned from 82nd Avenue onto 79th Street, started the last couple blocks towards our home, did I finally have to stop for a time. When I pulled up in front of the house, he, of course, had been watching And he came out down the steps, put his arms around me. And I heard that blessing again. That wonderful, wonderful blessing. We had a bit over 3 weeks together. And then I came down here to this place. Thursday, I think it was. He had gone to the doctor. I came down here to talk to Otto Rappland. Will you bury my father? So I was over here at Eplin's house, not knowing that my father was sent to the hospital by the doctor. And I talked with my godfather and then went home and went up to the hospital. And my father was beginning to cast his eyes towards the eternal. On Saturday morning, I went up early, and he had withered a great deal, but still, you know, was such a wiry man. And he had stopped this flood of memory, which comes sometimes to people. That had stopped. And I whispered to him, because for the first time in my life, I saw him with 3 days' growth on his chin. You know why I didn't? So I asked him, I said, "Can I shave you?" And he struggled to open his eyes, and he said, "Yeah." So I went to the bathroom, well, out of the hospital, and there was the old shaving mug that I knew from, you know, years back. But the razor, it was a beautiful ivory-handled razor. Now, for my father, with apologies to the clergy present, for my father, fine tools in the Bible were the same. They were both sacred. So I went and I raised him up and I moved around and laid him over me so I could shave him. And I asked him about this razor. "Where did you get this razor?" So he told me about going to 97th Street to a pawn shop. And that, of course, brought back a flood of memories, because we used to walk there every Saturday. And about how he'd gotten the razor there. And I was lathering him up, beginning to shave him. And of course, my salty tears were running down his face as well. In order to try and compose myself and finish shaving him, I turned to the most familiar talk we had in our home, theology. And I said to him, "Father, Father, do you think they had to shave in Eden?" As soon as the question mark was off my tongue, I realized I could not bear to say paradise. Our origins and our destiny are oddly one. He opened his eyes for the last time. "Call me by my name." That is the name that belongs here, Sonny Boy. And he said to me, "Sonny Boy, Sonny Boy."
had to in Eden. There is no had to in Eden. In the kingdom of God, in the commonwealth of God, in the eternal, there is no had to. He began to sing Norwegian hymns, and over the next several hours, sang himself into the eternal. There is no had to. Thank you so much. It's been lovely to, for Cam, I know, and for Eugene, for all of us to think with you and listen to you. Bless you.